So we're here today with Tom Lewis, whom we talked about recently about his series on why Trump cannot win. But now I want to focus on what was his original emphasis on his website, which is about the climate crisis. Tom, welcome to the state of Kentucky.
Thank you, Bruce, from West Virginia.
I came across your site while doing some research, and I was fascinated by the fact that you wrote regularly and cogently about the climate crisis. And then recently you announced you weren't going to write about it anymore. You were going to focus on politics, which we've been talking about. Why did you start writing about it, and then why did you stop?
Well, long ago in a galaxy far away, I was an editor at Time Life Books, and I was in charge of a series called Planet Earth about the earth sciences. And that put me in touch with some of the world's leading geologists and climatologists. And that's when I became really agitated about the environment and what we're doing to it. And also when I became aware of global climate change. I wrote my first national article on climate change in the early 90s. So I've been writing about it a long time. We knew the important people knew, the oil people knew, the scientists knew back then, and really in the 70s, what the greenhouse effect was, what it was likely to do, what the danger was. And I became engrossed in the subject and agitated to get the word out that this was a clear and present danger that people needed to be aware of. And that I've been doing that since then in every forum that I can get into. I have recently, several things have happened. I've gotten old and I have begun to find myself repeating myself. I've been writing the same article over and over again. I mean, I could publish that article I published in the 90s today about the effect, the possible effect of global climate change on wildlife, and it would probably be news to most of the people who looked at it. And and I got tired, and I also got very pessimistic. I don't think we're going to make it through this crisis. And if I may just say that in my writing for the last 15 years or so, it hasn't just been about climate change. It's been about a whole suite of existential threats to our civilization, our industrial civilization. To me, that's the villain, industry. The industrialization of everything equals the crapification of everything. And it's the industrial scale of everything that is endangering us, and I think is dooming our civilization. I think a massive correction is already underway. And I don't believe, after, like I say, 20, 30 years of writing on the subject, I don't believe anybody's doing anything serious about it.
When you say existential threat, that obviously can range in impact to some extent, but it sounds like you are saying that it's going to be not just, okay, parts of the earth become uninhabitable, which is the book that came out last year, The Uninhabitable Earth, but that it's actually going to affect even places like Kentucky that are somewhat isolated from some of the effects. Can you expand on what you mean when you say existential threat? How big is that?
I mean an existential threat to the industrial economy, and that's the economy of the majority of the world. Our population has overshot the capacity of the earth to maintain it, to sustain it. We have set global climate change in motion, and it's going to be a existential threat to millions of human beings, as is becoming apparent right now. The existential, I mean, is the existence of the industrial economy. We're going to have a crash, the mother of all crashes, and the only thing that's going to come out the other side is people that are living sustainably, and there aren't going to be many of those.
Mm-hmm.
Because it involves growing your own food. It involves producing your energy where you consume it. It involves living in such a way that you improve the circumstances around you, not degrade them. And there are people in many places of the earth, for many reasons, who are doing that now. And I think they'll come out the other side. There is a school of thought that says it's going to wipe out the human race. I don't buy that. Research recently claimed to show that at one point in the history of our species, we were down to 1,300 individuals on the planet. And we came back from that. I think we can come back from this. I think there are places in the world that will remain habitable. There are people in the world who will know how to handle that situation, but it's going to be a hard rain before we get there.
Okay, let's go with assuming that everything you say is true, and I'm not doubting it. I'm just saying let's use that as a hypothesis here.
You may be surprised to know there are people who doubt what I say.
Oh, no, I know that.
Most of them work for large oil companies.
Yes, yes. So what would you then recommend that those of us who are listening to this should do? What is the next steps we should be taking?
If one wants to survive what's coming, one has to get out of the city. One has to find some land in a reasonably safe space, learn to grow food, cut back on one's consumption of everything, and live sustainably. And everybody that I say that to say, well, I can't do that. I can't afford to do that. Well, okay then. then yours is the alternative. There are people, as I say, here and there around the world who are doing that because they believe they see what's coming. And the alternative is not a reduced income. The alternative is the worst imaginable. So they're doing it. And the thing with these things, they don't happen on schedule. People say, aren't you tired of not having any of your predictions come true? Well, no, I'm not, because they're all coming true. They're just coming true in sort of geologic time. Almost all of the predictions of 20 and 30 years ago about what global climate change was going to do, almost all of those things are happening right now. They're visibly happening. And we live in a country that is going through a presidential election right now in which none of those things are mentioned.
Right.
And if you live in Florida, you live in a state that has recently made it illegal to use the term climate change in any state paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Florida, which is the most endangered state from rising sea levels in the country.
So what sort of time frame, and I realize that this is just estimate work, what sort of time frame are you talking about for this?
I have no idea. Like I say, you know, this is like the predictions of the big earthquake on the San Andreas Fault, right? They've been out there for 30, 40 years, and everybody says, so much time has gone by, it's less and less likely. On the contrary, the more time goes by, the more likely it is, because time equals the buildup of tectonic pressures and makes the big one even bigger when it comes. But we're so used to news cycles that last for 48 hours and history that only goes back 6 months, that it's very difficult for many of us to comprehend the slowness with which big things happen. And climate change is a very big thing. Plus, it's a very complicated thing. And, you know, people walk onto the floor of the Senate and hold up a snowball and say, you see, climate change can't possibly be happening. So the complexity and the slowness are deluding people into being capable of denial of the whole thing, which is what a great many people are doing.
Have you had anybody in any sort of leadership, corporate, governmental, nonprofit, whatever, who has actually listened to you and tried to act on what you have written?
Well, it isn't so much listening to me. I'm one of many people that have been writing about these things. I see no leadership of any kind in any elected form in this country or any other that's proposing seriously to take any serious steps. I mean, look at the COP28 meeting, the Council of Partners to the United Nations Treaty. This is the worldwide commitment to fight climate change. They just had their 28th annual meeting to review the progress. Where did they have the meeting? In Dubai, a petro state. Who went to the meeting? The majority of the attendees were big oil lobbyists flying private jets into an exclusive resort.
Yeah.
They did some mealy-mouthed things about, boy, we're sure going to get on climate change pretty soon, all right, and they disbanded. And they've done that now for 28 consecutive successful years. This is what we get. We get the Biden administration asking rightly for credit for putting together the biggest climate bill ever. But that's because there wasn't ever any climate bill before. Hmm. And it's a drop in the bucket. The East Coast is going under. Florida is going under. Salt water is intruding into the farmlands and the aquifers of the East, South, and West coasts. Now, as we speak, climate migration has already begun in this country. People fleeing areas that have been made uninhabitable by sea level rise, wildfire, drought. It's underway now. And you can't find a politician in this country who will turn and look at it and say, you know what, this is an emergency. Okay, maybe there's one or two. Governor of Washington, it seems to me, said something like that recently. But anyway, very, very rare.
I'm interested by, you know, your books and some of the things that were in them. And it sounds to me like you have basically gone beyond where the books were and are saying, okay, it's over. It's too late for us to do anything except get ready for this crash that's coming. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. Yes. I logic tells me, and I'm not a scientist. I'm a reporter, but I report on what the scientists are publishing and saying. I mean, if you want to see somebody whose hair is on fire, the Secretary General of the United Nations has been warning the world that we're on the edge of a major disaster. Nobody's listening to him. Nobody that has the power, and I say the power, and nobody has that power, because the real culprit in this is the American and Western consumer, who will brook no inconvenience. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you a quick story to illustrate that. It was a gathering of people discussing climate change and its effects. And there was a speaker, and he laid out the case. And in the question period afterwards, somebody said, "Well, I get that there's a danger, and I get that there's bad things coming. What specifically should we do?" And the speaker said, "Well, to start with, would you accept a 15% surcharge on your electric bill so we can start rebuilding the grid and distributing energy and getting more sustainable energy?" The answer was immediate. Hell no. Hell no. Somebody else is going to have to pay. Somebody else is going to have to endure the inconvenience. Not me. I want you to fix it. I want you to come up with some technology, new gizmo that makes it unnecessary for me to inconvenience myself in any way. So the American consumer bears a very large share of the responsibility. The American consumer doesn't realize it, of course, or understand it, but it's the case.
So one thing that I do not remember reading in your books, and I may have missed it, or on your website, is the impact of this on governmental systems. What happens when we find out that our leaders have been cowards about this. And when it hits the fan, what do you think is going to happen to our governmental setup?
Well, when we get to that point, it'll be so far down the road, there probably won't be any government. I mean, we're going to lose. When you talk about losing the industrial base, you're talking about the internet's gone. You're talking about the cell phones are gone. You're talking about the grid is gone. Nobody's going to be worried about what they're doing in Washington. It's going to be survival time. And our horizons, those who survive, I have always said that I'm an age optimist. I'm confident I'm going to be dead before this happens. And I count on it because I'm too old to make the preparations necessary. So I just soon be out of here before it comes in the door. And I think I've got a good chance. But it's when it does happen, when the crash does come, it's going to be it'll speed up then. Events will not go slowly then. I mean, they keep talking about tipping points. You know, there's a tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean right now. The lateral circulation of the Atlantic Ocean, the Gulf Stream, for example, is slowing down. And if it slows much more, the climate of Europe, England and Europe, is going to change dramatically and instantly. It's no longer going to be temperate. Things like that. And there are tipping points all over the place that scientists have been warning us about for years, and we just head toward them.
So in terms of watching for the signs, you talked about the climate in Europe. One of the things that I have read about is the impact on food supply and water supply.
Yeah, those were major parts of my book. And I read, there was an article up today. I cannot give you the citation, but it reviewed the crop situation as of now in the major crop growing regions of the world. And a national NGO that's concerned with food supply said we are on the verge of a major global crisis in food supply because of the failure of crops. See, one of the other villains here is industrial agriculture. My mantra for years has been, if it's industrial, it's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. Industrial agriculture destroys topsoil and has been doing so with abandon worldwide for decades. Industrial agriculture pollutes surface waters to the extent that because of agricultural runoff, the dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River is the size of Rhode Island, an area in which nothing can live. This is going on unrestrained, and it continues to go on. The industrial agriculture wastes water. The Ogallala Aquifer that underlies the most productive agricultural land of this country is almost gone. And that doesn't replenish overnight. It doesn't replenish for centuries. And when they start sucking air with those multiple straws that are in the Ogallala Aquifer that provides necessary irrigation without which you don't get a crop when you're west of a certain meridian in the United States, that's going to bring on a food crisis. So it's all these things that are building and are going unrestrained. Right now, you know, they're trying to do something about the river that goes down to Mexico. It doesn't meet the sea anymore. And they're trying to divide up the very last drops of water that exist in that river. And it's not going to be replenished. It's not coming back. It's going away. I have put you into a deep depression, haven't I?
No. These are all things that I was aware of. It's just having to put them all into one interview can get somewhat depressing. Yes.
It's a funny thing. We're aware of the parts of the thing, And one of the ways that we achieve denial, which is not just a river in Egypt, is that we refrain from putting the parts together. We just don't do it.
Right.
When you do it, it takes on a shape that isn't nice.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the fact that you have talked about this and written about this for years. I appreciate your books and your website, and I appreciate your honesty. I believe that, you know, you're telling it the way we need to hear it. I will take a look at some of the preparations you mentioned. I think that, you know, not for me so much, but for my right. children, we need to be thinking about that. If somebody wants to get more information, is your website a good place, or are there other places they should go? Where should people go to dig deeper into what you have said?
That's a good question. There's a good deal of environmental reporting being done now. Let me give that some thought and shoot you an email so you could put up something with the interview, perhaps. I need to think that over.
Okay, that'll be fine.
I will tell you. Let me just tell you a brief. When I was working on the book Brace for Impact, I was at a New Year's Eve party, and this lovely young lady sidled up to me and said, "So, what are you working on?" And I said, "I'm working on a book." She said, "What's it about?" I said, "It's about the fact that the industrial economies of the world are about to collapse, and there's nothing we can do about it." And there was a brief pause. She looked at me. She said, "Is this where I bet?" My eyes and smile and move away. So I said, "No, I won't talk about it anymore."
Right. Yeah. It can certainly be a conversation killer, but so can serious medical diagnoses. I mean, you got to face it. If you don't face it, it just gets worse. Tom Lewis, author, editor. Thank you so much for your time, and send me that list of places or things, and I will add it to the text under the interview.
Okay. Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate your interest.
All right. Bye-bye.